Invite you to open your Bibles to Luke 15 if you have your Bible with you, continuing our series in Luke's Gospel. If you don't have a Bible and would like to borrow one, there's some at the back. If you don't own one, please feel free to take one of those as our gift to you. Before I start, let me just preface my introductory story by letting you know Chrisleen is away at Breakforth, but I have her permission to share this story. So, when you get married to someone, many of you have experienced this, you tend to discover a lot of things that you may not have known ahead of time. One thing that I discovered shortly after marrying Chrisleen was this weird thing that she did at night. Whenever she would go to the washroom at night and when it was dark, she would flush the toilet and run out of the washroom super fast. It kind of confused me. I'm like, what? What's that all about? It just seemed weird and unusual. I never did that. I said, like, what's the deal? She said, I don't know. But she'd flush it and boom. You just had to make sure you weren't in the way or she'd bully you over in the hallway. And so over the months, though, as we got to know one another better and you continue to grow and you think and you wonder, and I got to know her family better and you hear stories, I began to, there was a day where all of a sudden it clicked for me. And though she had never realized this, all of a sudden it made sense. Chrisleen, many of you know, was born in Africa, in the Congo, and she grew up. She was six when her family moved back to Canada. And so some family reunion, someone was telling a story, and there's a story about how, my mother-in-law, someone mentioned the fact that in Congo, when you went to the washroom, particularly at night, you always had to check around the base of the toilet and in the toilet for snakes. And I thought, that's why. As a little girl, this just got into her head, and so in the dark, there would be this fear that she didn't even understand what it was for. But it revealed sort of what was at the heart of that weird thing that I discovered. She's over that now, but it was kind of a funny thing. But discovered the heart of this fear, the heart of this habit. This morning, we come to a parable that probably most of us are familiar with, and it is, I think, profoundly helpful for us, this story that Jesus tells in discovering and understanding the heart of our faith, the heart of Christianity. Unlike perhaps any other parable, this parable exposes our problem as humanity, the ways we try and overcome it, and the ways in which God, through Christ, has come to save us, redeem us. And so we're going to walk through this. And I think, hopefully, God will open our eyes and our hearts to understand our own faith. For those of you who are believers already, for those who aren't, that this will give you a greater window into the heart of Christianity, what Christianity is really all about. I want to do five things with you in our time together. I'm going to begin by making some introductory observations about this parable that is, like I said, probably very familiar to most of us. Second, we will explore Act 1. The part of the story focused on the younger brother. Third, we'll focus on Act 2, which turns our attention to the older brother. Fourth, I want us to contemplate the matter of sin and lostness. What does it mean when we talk about sin and lostness? And then fifth and finally, we will focus our attention on the role that Jesus plays in the story that Jesus tells. So first, some introductory comments. This parable, of course, if you've been with us, this parable follows immediately on the heels of two others. Earlier in Luke 15, we looked at them last week, there was the parable of the lost sheep, followed by the parable of the lost coin. Now, these parables all together are linked thematically. They are very much related, but we are going to look at it in two parts. Last week, we looked at the first two, and this week, we'll look at the last one. Now, those two parables, the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin, confronted us with this marvelous picture of a searching God, a God who loves those who are lost, a God who longs for those who are lost to come home, a God who searches for those who are lost, and who delights, whose heart bursts with joy every time a lost person comes home, every time the text says a sinner repents. His heart overflows with joy in all of heaven erupts in celebration. This third parable, though linked and shares some of those same themes of God's love, God's longing, God's joy when the lost are found, it also leads us to reflect on some different things the theme of sin and lostness, the reality of what is our problem as human beings and how has God acted to solve that problem. The second thing I want to note by way of observation as we begin is that the title that we typically refer to this parable is what? The parable of the lost son, parable of the prodigal son. How many of you know what prodigal means? Prodigal, according to the dictionary, I'll read it to you, characterized by profuse or wasteful expenditure, reckless spendthrift, one who spends or gives lavishly and foolishly. Parable of the prodigal son. And applied to the younger brother, the younger son in the parable, it makes sense. As we see in a moment, he is incredibly wasteful. He recklessly blows a ton of wealth in foolish ways. Thus, it's entirely appropriate to apply that term to him, the prodigal son. But nonetheless, I want to suggest that it's a bit problematic to call this parable the parable of the prodigal son, or even the parable of the lost son. Why? Because the younger son is not the only character in this story, and Jesus tells it not only for the point that we will learn in looking at the younger son. There is an older son who plays a vital role. In fact, I would suggest that perhaps Jesus' emphasis actually falls on the older son. There are three major characters in this story. There is the younger son, the prodigal son, there is the older son, and there is the father. All three are important, and we need to focus on all three as we walk through this. Interestingly, pastor and author Timothy Keller has written a book on this. He entitled it The Prodigal God, The Wasteful God, the God who recklessly, wastefully pours out. As we explore this story this morning, this parable, we will come to see why Keller did that. And I want to contend, as I said, that this story is not primarily, certainly not only, about the younger son. In fact, Jesus never refers to it as the story, the parable of the lost son. Jesus says, there was a man who had two sons. Each of these three characters, the younger son, the older son, and the father, are significant actors in this story. One last thing before I turn to our text and read it for you. And that is, I want to remind you of who it is Jesus is speaking to here. The beginning of chapter 15, Jesus, before he shares the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin, do you remember who it is that was gathered around him? Luke tells us that tax collectors and sinners were gathering around to hear Jesus. And he also told us that Pharisees and teachers of the law were there muttering, this man welcomes sinners and even eats with them. Let me read our text. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home and you kill the fattened calf for him?" "My son," the father said, "you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Let's focus our attention for the next few minutes on Act 1, the first part of the parable, the first part of the story that focuses our attention on the younger brother. Now, because many of us are familiar with the story, we face the likelihood of missing the utterly shocking nature of the younger son's request. The story opens with the younger son coming to his father and saying, "Father, give me my share of the estate." Now, what's shocking is not the son's expectation of an inheritance. That's not shocking. In that world, when a father would die, his property, all that he had, his wealth would be divided by his sons. The older son would get a double portion, and the other sons would get half of as much as the oldest. So in this case, with two boys, the older son would get 2/3 of the estate. The younger son could reasonably expect that he would inherit 1/3 of his father's estate. It's not shocking that he expected an inheritance. What is shocking is the timing of his request. The division of an estate happened, as one would expect, at the time of the death of the father. Father would die, and at that point, the estate would be divided up appropriately. To ask his father for his share of the estate now, while the father was very much alive, was to wish his father dead. It was to say, "I don't care about you. I don't care for you. I don't want you. I want your stuff. Just give me what's mine." Here we encounter another shock as we listen to the story. Or at least we would if we weren't so familiar with it. In an honor-shame culture such as the one in which this story takes place, in which the original listeners are hearing it as Jesus tells it, Jesus' listeners would have been rushing ahead. I don't know if you've ever heard a story and or someone's reading it or telling a story and you anticipate what's coming next. I mean, no doubt, as Jesus tells the story, his listeners know what's coming next. They're anticipating. They're rushing ahead of Jesus as Jesus tells the story. They knew how the father would respond. They knew how the father would respond to this disrespectful, offensive request. He would send his son on his way, all right, with a beating. The nerve, the disrespect, the impertinence of this young man. But instead of that, what Jesus' listeners, instead of what they were expecting, they watch. They hear Jesus as he says, the father, in fact, did what his son requested. The father divides his estate. The father begins selling portions of his property. He begins selling some of his herds and flocks. He liquidates 1/3 of all that he has, and he gives it to his son. And his son turns and walks away, abandoning his father, abandoning home. Imagine for a moment the pain of loss for that father. The loss of honor and the pain of rejection. We read on. The younger son set off for a distant country and there squandered his wealth in wild living. He blows everything. He wastes all his wealth. I don't know about you, but I, as a sports fan, I think the amounts of money many of these people receive is ridiculous. But what is always stunning to me is when you hear a story of some athlete who a few years after retirement is broke. How can you do that? How can you waste millions? How can you retire and have nothing after making millions and millions and millions? This kid, this young man, wastes an enormous amount of wealth. It's gone. Wild living, parties and prostitutes, a life of complete debauchery. And then Jesus says, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. This young Jewish man, probably just a teenager, has nothing. He's homeless. He's hungry. And so in desperation, he looks for work, and the job he finds is feeding unclean pigs. He's so desperate, he's so hungry, that he longs to eat what he's feeding the pigs. But no one even gives him that. And it's at this point in the story that he comes to his senses. He has a moment of clarity, and he realizes, you know what, even those who are hired servants for my father, the hired hands, they have more than enough food to eat. He knows he can't go back as a son, not after what he's done, but maybe his father will hire him. Maybe he can go back and work and eat. So he abandons the pigsty and he begins the long journey home, rehearsing as he goes his speech to his father. Filled, no doubt, with trepidation matched only by his desperation, hoping against hope that he'll be taken back as a hired hand. And then in verse 20 we read this, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. In that culture, patriarchs didn't do this. Patriarchs didn't hike up their gowns, their robes, bare their legs, and run, but this father did. He endured whatever humility that would have brought. He saw his son, his heart was filled with compassion. He lifted up his robe and he ran. And he falls upon his son with hugs and kisses. The son begins his speech, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father doesn't wait for him to finish. He interrupts. He hollers to the servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on, and put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." What an incredibly startling response. Tim Keller writes this: God's love and forgiveness can pardon and restore any and every kind of sin or wrongdoing. It doesn't matter who you are or what you've done. It doesn't matter if you've deliberately oppressed or even murdered people or how much you've abused yourself. The younger brother knew that in his father's house there was abundant food to spare, but he also discovered that there was grace to spare. There is no evil that the Father's love cannot pardon and cover. There is no sin that is a match for His grace. Any wonder Keller named his book, The Prodigal God, the wasteful God, the God who pours out His abundant grace recklessly, abundantly, lavishly. He pours it out before the son cleans himself up, before the son proves anything, before the son gives evidence of an actual inner heart change, before he even gets through his speech. The father's love and acceptance are absolutely free. What an incredibly startling message. And I think if we're honest, maybe a little unsettling. And certainly to those in the first century listening to Jesus, not only unsettling, but infuriating. Let's turn our attention to Act 2 and the older brother. I want to read a quote from Tim Keller again. He says this, it's a mistake, I alluded to this earlier, it's a mistake to think that Jesus tells this story primarily to assure younger brothers of his unconditional love, though it certainly does that. No, the original listeners were not melted into tears by this story, but rather they were thunderstruck, offended, and infuriated. Jesus' purpose is not to warm our hearts, but to shatter our categories. Through this parable, Jesus challenges what nearly everyone has ever thought about God, sin, and salvation. His story reveals the destructive self-centeredness of the younger brother. but it also condemns the elder brother's moralistic life in the strongest terms. Jesus is saying both the irreligious and the religious are spiritually lost. Both life paths are dead ends, and that every thought the human race has had about how to connect to God has been wrong. This isn't a story about one lost son. This is a story of two lost sons. They've chosen different paths, but as we will see in a moment, both are equally lost. Both are equally in need of God's grace. Act 2 begins in verse 25, where we read, "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field." The older son has stayed with the father. The older son has been working for the father. He's been working in the field, laboring in the field, working for his father. And as he comes near the house, he hears the sounds of a party. He hears music and dancing, and he calls over one of the servants and he says, "What's going on? I didn't know we had anything planned for tonight. What am I hearing? What's up?" And the servant tells him, "Your brother's back. Your dad's throwing a party because your brother's back safe and he's home." I just read the story, so we know what happens. The older son is furious. He's angry. And now he does something to bring disgrace upon his father. He refuses to go in. He stands outside the celebration, publicly just showing disdain for his father, demonstrating that he disagrees, repudiates what his father is doing. And can imagine other guests maybe looking out from the celebration and seeing the older son steaming on the edge of the field. The father once more bears disgrace. He leaves his guests, he leaves the celebration, and he goes out to his son. And Jesus says he went out and pleaded with him. The father goes to the older son who has never left him, and he pleads with him. But his eldest son refuses, and out of his mouth explode these words, "Look! All these years, I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. Never, yet you never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." These are telling words, if we slow down and reflect. "I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed you. And you never gave me even a goat to have a party with my friends." Two things for us to note. Though outwardly the older son is good, he's never left the father. He's been working hard for the father. He's been obeying everything the father has asked him to do. Though outwardly he is good, though outwardly he's been doing what he's supposed to do, yet here we recognize, don't we, that something is desperately wrong. And second, his words betray the fact that he does not truly love his father. He doesn't want his father. He doesn't want the things his father wants. He doesn't want to celebrate what his father celebrates. He doesn't want his father. He doesn't love his father. He wants stuff from his father, just like his younger brother. Here's what we need to recognize. Though the older son looked good, though the older son worked hard for his father, he too, just like his younger brother, is lost. He's lost. He's alienated from the father. And that leads us to the fourth thing we wanted to reflect on, and that is our understanding of sin and lostness. With this parable, Jesus reveals to us powerfully that there are two ways that we can go wrong, that there are two very different ways we can choose to live our lives, but both are spiritual dead ends. There is the way of the younger brother, the way of irreligion, where we thumb our nose at God, We reject God and say, I will do what I want to do. No one's going to tell me what to do. I will pursue what I want to pursue. I know what will make me happy. I know what will satisfy my heart. I will do my own thing. And we see that. We recognize that. Maybe we've experienced that. Maybe you even see little spots in your life where you recognize that. But we recognize younger brother rebellion, the younger brother way of life that leads, we see in this parable, to a dead end. Spiritual bankruptcy, poverty. The way of the older brother, on the other hand, looks quite different, doesn't it? I mean, compared to the younger brother, his life looks pretty together. It looks pretty good, actually. It's the way of moral conformity, of following the rules, of doing what is expected, being disciplined. But as we see, he too is lost. He's alienated from the father. Both sons, though in different ways, are alienated from their father. One rebelled by breaking the rules, the other by keeping them all. Which sounds strange, I know. That's exactly what we see in the story. He kept all the rules, not to get God, but to get something from God. It was his way of trying to use God for his own purposes. It looks different than the younger brother, but it is remarkably similar. And both are alienated from their father. Neither son loved the father. Neither son cared for the joy, the delight of their father. They both sought to use their father for their own self-centered ends. The younger brother demanding his inheritance so he could go and do whatever his heart desired. The older brother meticulously keeping the rules, believing that somehow he was earning whatever his heart desired from his father. That's why he's angry. That's why he's angry, because his father didn't even give him a goat so he could have a party with someone else. Look at all I did for you. I kept the rules. I worked hard. I lived a good moral life. And God, you're not giving me what I want. It's just as self-centered. And his heart is just as alienated from the father as his son, as his brother. And I would contend that though both sons are lost, the older brother's lostness is more dangerous spiritually. See, the younger brother's lostness is clear and obvious. It's easy to see. He himself recognized it pretty plainly. Just like those that he represented in Jesus' audience that day, the tax collectors and the other sinners, they knew they were spiritually screwed up. They knew that if it depended on them, they were without hope. And that's why Jesus is so attractive to them. Because they see in Jesus this love and this grace that extends to people like them who've screwed everything up. Younger brother lostness is easy to see. It's easy to recognize. But older brother lostness is more dangerous because it's so easy to fail to see our need for grace, because it looks like we're doing good. We're working so hard. We're keeping the rules. We're living moral lives. Those who are like this older brother think, we tend to think that sin is just violating a set of rules, a set of laws, guidelines. But see, this is what we need to recognize about sin. Sin is far deeper than that. Our sin problem is not just that we don't manage to keep the rules, that we just don't manage to do what we're called to do. It's that, but it's more. It's far deeper and it's far worse. Sin at its root is that our hearts are drawn to the wrong things, that our hearts are idolatrous, that our hearts have attached themselves to lesser things, things other than God, things that we pursue. Keller writes, if, like the older brother, you believe that God ought to bless you and help you because you've worked so hard to obey him and be a good person, then Jesus may be your helper, your example, even your inspiration, but he's not your Savior. You're serving as your own Savior. See, sin is more than just a list of rules. Sin is the idolatrous desire for anything other than God, more than God. Sin is looking to anything or anyone other than God to satisfy the deepest longings of your heart. Sin is a matter of misdirected desires, of misdirected affections. And so whether we rebel against God like the younger brother and live lives of blatant sin, or we strive to obey meticulously as a means of leveraging God to get the things we want from Him, in either case, our hearts are attached to the wrong thing. And we all stand in desperate need of having our hearts transformed, our affections transformed, and for that, we all desperately need grace. Only God's grace can forgive our sin, but only God's grace can transform our hearts. Only God's grace can transform our affections. The final piece of the message this morning, I want us to focus on the role that Jesus plays in the story that Jesus tells. I've noted that this parable stands in relationship with the two that came before it, the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin. They are similar in various ways, but there's one difference I want to draw your attention to right now. What happened in the first two parables that does not happen here? Someone goes searching. A sheep is lost, and the shepherd goes and searches. A coin is lost, and this woman lights a lamp and sweeps her house and searches diligently. But in this story, no one goes searching. That should jump out at us. No one's searching. Have you ever wondered why that is the case? Have you ever asked yourself, why is no one searching? Who should have gone searching? If the older brother loved his father, if the older brother cared for his father, he would have recognized the pain of rejection, the pain of loss. And he would have gone out, searched for his brother, searched, recognizing his father's longing for restoration. He would have searched. Tim Keller, again, to quote him, he puts these words in the mouth of the older brother. "Father, my younger brother has been a fool, and now his life is in ruins. But I will go and look for him and bring him home. And if the inheritance is gone, as I expect it is, I'll bring him back to the family. I'll bring him back into the family at my expense." I don't know if you've realized this before. Sometimes people look at this story and go, why can't God just forgive us? Why do we need sacrifice and atonement? And God, the Father just forgives the Son. That's actually to miss a really important detail. The restoration of the younger son cost a lot. Right? Who did it cost? Actually cost the older son. Because the father divided his estate. Everything that is left belongs to the older son. The father is throwing a party for the younger son on the older son's dime. There is a cost to restoration. There is a cost to forgiveness. But if the younger son had loved his father and cared for what his father cared for, he might have said these words that I just read. But this younger brother has a Pharisee for a brother. A Pharisee who is bitter and angry and has no desire to pay that price. But here's the good news. Jesus is the true older brother. Jesus willingly left a faraway country. Jesus left heaven and came to earth to search for lost younger brothers. He came to search not only for younger brothers, but Pharisaical older brothers. He came to search, willing to pay the price at the cost of his own life on the cross to find us, to reconcile us to the Father, to draw us back into the family. Jesus goes to the cross and pays the price. He pays the penalty for our sin, for our broken, rebellious, idolatrous hearts. Jesus suffers and dies. And then he cries out, "Put the best robe on them, the robe of his righteousness." And he puts a ring on our finger and makes us family. And they celebrate. All of heaven erupts in joy every time one of us recognizes our deep need for God's grace. Jesus is the true older brother who has done all that is necessary to restore us, to reconcile us, to make us part of the family, to clothe us with the best robe, his robe of righteousness. Keller writes, "But by putting a flawed elder brother in the story, Jesus is inviting us to imagine and to yearn for a true one. And we have one. Think of the kind of brother we need. We need one who does not just go to the next country to find us, but who will come all the way from heaven to earth. We need one who is willing to pay not just a finite amount of money, but at the infinite cost of his own life to bring us into God's family. For our debt is far more great, so much greater." I don't know where you see yourself in this story this morning. It's easier to see younger brother-ishness. Those places in our lives, or maybe our life more wholly, where we just say, I don't need God, I'm going to do my own thing. I think in the church, older brother-ishness is probably a bigger challenge. We strive to obey, and you know what? We're called to obey. Obedience is good, it's important, but what's going on in our heart beneath that obedience matters supremely. And if you recognize in yourself this morning that you find yourself striving to obey God out of fear, or if you recognize in moments of your life when life goes off the rails that you get angry either at God because he's not giving you what you think you should get, or maybe you're angry at yourself because you go, "I'm just screwing up too much, this is my fault." But if you recognize anger when life is hard, then I invite you to come to Jesus and say, "Jesus, change my heart. I need your grace. I need your grace not just to forgive this list of sins that I can point to. I need your grace to transform my heart. Jesus, I want to love the Father. I want to care more for him than for anything else. I want to pursue him above everything else. Jesus, I need your grace." And know that Jesus, the true elder brother, will lavish upon you recklessly. He will pour it out in abundance. His grace is more than sufficient. Brothers and sisters, only grace can change our hearts. Only grace can deal with our biggest problem. Our problem is far greater than that we transgress some rules, some boundaries, some laws. It's that, but it's far deeper. Sin is a deeper problem. And Jesus has come to pour out his grace in our lives, to transform our affections, to transform our hearts, so that we become women and men, young and old, whose hearts beat for the Father who longs for us and who celebrates, whose heart bursts with joy when we come home and rest in his embrace. Amen.